Good afternoon. It's approximately 1:35 p.m. We are in suite 907 on the ninth floor of the DNA building. And again, Guam, in the OPA hearing room. I'm Anthony Camacho. I'm presiding as hearing officer. This is the case of in the appeal of Townhouse Department Stores, Inc., doing businesses, Island Business Systems and Supplies, OPA-PA-11-02. And we are here for a pre-hearing conference and a hearing on the appellant's motion to dismiss Xerox's appearance. Will the members of the Office of Public Accountability that are present for this hearing today please identify themselves for the record?
Doris Flores Brooks, Public Auditor.
Derek Hernandez, Community Post Doc.
Thank you. Will the appellant, counsel for the appellant, please identify himself for the record and any institutional representative with him today?
Thank you, Mr. Hearing Officer. My name is John Thomas Brown. I'm general counsel for the appellant IBSS, and I have no one with me here today.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Will counsel for the purchasing agency please identify herself for the record and any institutional representative with her this morning or this afternoon?
Rebecca Perez for the Guam Department of Education. Present with me is DOE's Supply Management Administrator, Marcus Pito.
Thank you, Ms. Perez. Will counsel for the interested party please identify herself for the record and any institutional representatives with her this afternoon?
Thank you. Elise Iriarty of Carl Smith Ball for Xerox Corporation. No one else from Xerox is present today.
Thank you, Mr. Iriarty. We're basically here for a pre-hearing conference, but as this case has been held in abeyance now for, I want to say it's been at least 1 year, perhaps more, and just for the record, pursuant to DOE's motion to dismiss, that's from last year, which we denied, we did hold the case in abeyance until the parties had settled or resolved CV 1536-10, which was a civil case. And I believe to date DOE and the appellant have done so. Is that correct, Mr. Brown?
Yes, sir. There's been a negotiated dismissal of that action.
Okay. Is that also correct, Ms. Paris?
That is my understanding, and it's also my understanding that once that dismissal was filed, then there was no objection that this case would be brought back before the OPA.
That's correct. We didn't dismiss the case. We merely held it in abeyance pursuant to the appellate rules of procurement appeals to hold in advance until the civil matter, which dealt with issues, was resolved. So I guess the big issue now is, as we're not party to that case or that civil case, were any of the underlying issues of the appeal or Mr. Brown, your client's protest, were they resolved? And
I took the position all along, Mr. Hearing Officer, that there were no underlying issues, legal issues, in that 7103 action and in this appeal. The factual matters that were disposed of never involved any of this action. So to answer your question, I don't know how to answer your question.
Well, the question was, you know, okay. Well, let me ask it another way. Okay, is it your desire to continue your appeal in this case?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
If it would clarify matters, and because OPA has stated it's not a party to 1536, has OPA received a copy of the dismissal and orders on records? Just want to be sure that we're all looking at this. It was filed in court. So,
it was filed. Yeah. I believe the attorney Marr mentioned to me that he had made that available to OPA, but I'm not.
It was served on me. It was a copy of that dismissal. And I want to say that was approximately, that was approximately a week or two ago.
Okay.
And then I know that Delia wasn't part of SP 103-11, but that was, I believe, no, you weren't.
We're not part of the signing parties to the orders in 103. However, I was present for at least a few of the hearings. And it is my understanding, and I think it's relevant to this matter, that 1536-10 was stipulated and dismissed. That any objections, again, that there might have been to proceeding in this appeal, which I believe were addressed in 103, were then taken off the table. And that's in 103, were we not remanded back?
Well, yeah, in SP 103-11, which was the appellant's appeal of the public auditors basically holding in abeyance of the matter, or this matter, as part of the stipulation in order to dismiss, the OPA was ordered basically to restart these proceedings within 2 weeks after it received, I guess, a dismissal of CV 1536-10. We've done so, hence.
I'm just asking for clarification and just for the record. I know that both other, the interested party and the appellant, their counsels, had the benefit of being at this case from the start. This case was in movement for the OPA when Mr. Pito came to the department. He was barely there for a month when this started. I was not the previous attorney handling this case, so I just wanted to make sure for the record that I was of the same impression of what had occurred and what brought us back here, and that I think you just explained. So.
Okay. Is that clear as mud, Ms. Iriarte?
Yeah, I agree with the characterization of last year's events.
Okay. Okay. Well, anyway, so if we're going to proceed with this case, there were three motions that were pending at the time where we had left off, and we had, and those were basically the appellant's motion to disclose a procurement record, which was filed on February the 10th of 2011, the appellant's motion for interested party Xerox Corporation, or that was for them to disclose some information in Xerox Corporation's files. That was filed on February the 15th of 2011. And then there was interested party Xerox's motion to dismiss the appeal, which was filed on February the 25th, 2011. The actual hearing for those motions was held, I believe, sometime in, I want to say it was April the 27th of 2011. And those motions were basically held in abeyance. They were originally taken under advisement, but as a result of holding the case in abeyance, they were not decided. So we do owe you a decision for those three motions. And then after those motions were heard, I believe that's when the appellant had filed its motion to dismiss Xerox, interested party Xerox motion's appearance in this matter. And that was the last remaining motion. Originally, that was taken under advisement, but the OPA then had stated that it would entertain motions to actually hear or have a or hold a hearing on that motion. And I believe basically we treated the appellant's request for clarity in its order as kind of a request for a hearing. So that's the first order of business. Mr. Thomas, are we prepared to argue that motion today, or do you need some additional time for that?
No, it'll be brief. I've already provided an extensive motion on the subject and points and authority, so I just have a brief oral argument to make.
Okay, we'll start with that motion then. Mr. Thomas, you have the floor on your motion to dismiss Xerox, each party Xerox's appearance in this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Hearing Officer. This motion to dismiss Xerox is based on the disclosure requirements in 5 GCA 5233 and whether those disclosure requirements have been met. So let's begin by an examination of just exactly what disclosure is required. It requires specific minimal information, the name and address, and the numeric or percentage ownership interest of any person who has held more than 10% of the outstanding shares of the bidder at any time, not every time, at any time during the 12-month period preceding the submission of the bid. And it's important to get that straight because Xerox has framed the law a bit differently from that in its motion. If a bidder discloses the name and the address and the percentage interest of any person who has held more than 10% ownership during the requisite time frame, the bidder has done precisely what the law requires. If the bidder also discloses more than is required, the bidder has not violated the statute. For instance, if the bidder discloses all owners and interests or the legal interest of record of the deceased owner, the bidder has not violated the statute as additional information that was not required. So long as a 10% disclosure test is met, disclosure of additional information is not a violation. This is a disclosure law, not a perjury law. As appellant has pointed out in the motions and points and authorities and such as that, Xerox's Securities and Exchange Commission filing detailed that Xerox did not meet the affirmative disclosure requirement of the statute. It violated the law by failing to disclose the name, address, and percentage ownership interest of an actual owner whose interest met both the quantum and time frame parameters, as well as by affirmatively stating none of its ownership's required disclosure. Xerox came to this tribunal claiming that appellant falsely named the 10% owner. Not that appellant failed to name the actual 10% owner, but that appellant failed to name an additional, falsely named an additional person who it claimed had no interest because that person was dead. Xerox's legal arguments to dismiss appellant were gleefully clear, unequivocal, and admitting of no exception. It is not simply ironic that Xerox itself failed of the very thing the statute requires. It runs foul of an ancient golden rule. I've elaborated appellant's argument in the motion, the appellant's response to Xerox opposition, and the points and authorities, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ms. Parris?
At this point, we have nothing to add. We believe that the briefs, we'll let the OPA speak to the briefs handled by both the appellant and the interested party.
Okay, so you really need to submit under brief, or I believe you did file some opposition or some response.
To this, I'm sorry, but on my review of the record, that was difficult for me to see. I didn't see that we had to the appellant, to Mr. Brown's to Mr. Brown's motion in this manner. I don't believe we filed anything in this position.
All right, but you have no position on this? So.
Not on the specifics of Mr. Brown's current motion before the OPA.
All right. Ms. Iriarte?
Thank you. The first point I want to raise is the recent memorandum of points and authorities that IBSS filed on April 13, 2012. Back in April 27, 2011, the OPA issued a scheduling order for this motion and said, this is the date for the opposition and this is the date for the reply. So we believe that that memorandum of points and authorities has been untimely filed and should be stricken from the record. Moving on to the substantive response, we believe that IBSS's argument flies in the face of the regulatory definition of an interested party, the OPA's prior decisions on parties' appearance and participation in proceedings, and also the fundamental concept of due process. On the first point, which is how Xerox is able to appear in this case, it's able to appear as an interested party, which is defined in section 12102 as an actual or prospective bidder, offeror, or contractor who has a substantial and reasonable prospect of receiving an award if the appeal is denied. There is no other test. In this case, Xerox is the actual bidder, which is now performing on the contract that DOE awarded. So to dismiss Xerox's appearance would be basically depriving it of the opportunity to participate as an interested party, as it's allowed to under this rule. The OPA issued a decision in OPA PA-10-10 on a similar motion that IBSS filed in that case against Xerox, moving to strike their appearance. And in that decision, the OPA said that since Guam's procurement law mandates good faith and objective evaluation of bids, firms who have submitted bids must be allowed to be heard in order to protect the integrity of the procurement process. We agree that the same interest is of concern here. The integrity of the procurement process can only be preserved by allowing the party that is now performing under the contract and was awarded the bid to continue to participate in these proceedings. So that leads just finally to the last point, which is Xerox's due process right to be here. Extending apart from the definition of interested party, there are some issues that Xerox has raised in this proceeding that if Xerox is deprived of the ability to participate, would be a great disservice to the public. One of the issues we've raised is whether or not IBSS has actually filed a timely protest based on their protest of the language of the bid. We've presented that in our motion to dismiss. Our other position is that the invitation for bids, which is at issue here, allows an increase in quantities, which is basically the general issue that's at stake here. Xerox is able to produce evidence that IFB allowed an increase in quantities, and we should be able to put that evidence on at the hearing. And finally, what IBSS is trying to do here is to take a basis for a protest and turn it into a motion to dismiss Xerox's appearance. IBS did not protest to DOE on Xerox's affidavit. That issue was never before DOE. And what they're doing now is trying to sneak it in as a way to dismiss Xerox's appearance without having adequately preserved that issue at the agency level. And so we believe that since it was not a part of the protest, they shouldn't be allowed to raise it in this manner. Based on all of that, we don't even have to get to the accuracy of Xerox's affidavit. And we ask that the OPA deny the motion to dismiss Xerox's appearance.
Thank you, Ms. Iriarte. Mr. Brown?
Yes, thank you. Interesting arguments. The idea is that you should ignore Xerox's failure to comply with the section of 5233, which has been held in similar circumstances to require the dismissal of an awarded bidder. In GTA's case, they had been awarded the contract, but the contract was terminated and they were dismissed of its efficacy. And Xerox would have us look to the merits that were raised in the protest itself about the substantial and beyond out of scope of the contract changes that were made to the contract. Wants us just to ignore the fact that they came into this with a, but they don't dispute a false affidavit of ownership. Now, they argue about due process and timing and everything. Xerox brought the same claim against appellant late in the game with no concern at all for appellant's due process. Xerox claims that it's an interested party, and that's not the same thing as an aggrieved person, but it's the definition of an interested party is that it's an aggrieved or potential bidder. That's the same definition that anybody would have to protest and be party to an appeal. So I don't see that's a distinction with a difference. Xerox argued that the the integrity of the process is befouled. The integrity of the process, according to the arguments that Xerox made against appellant, was that you don't get to that point. If you are a person who has a bidder who has failed to provide this document, you're non-responsive by definition. Now, there's plenty of case law that says that responsiveness is akin to standing, and that if you fail in your efforts to be responsive, you have no standing. You're the proverbial man on the street. You have no interest in this thing. Now, the fact that it's a post-award is really meaningless because it's based on how that award was made. This protest was brought because it was discovered after the award had been made that there were significant changes made. So this is a protest of the award. This is not a technical post-award This is not a contract dispute, in other words. If it's a post-award dispute, it's a contract dispute. This is not a contract dispute. This is a dispute of the award. This arises out of the award, out of the solicitation and the award. They don't jive. What was solicited was not awarded. And so they can't slip away from this argument that they failed to be responsive. And I've, in more particularity and in a probably more clear state of mind, written to those objections. Those aren't new objections. They restate the objections that we made when the appellant first brought this up. So my responses to this are also in the memorandum. I don't believe that it should, the memorandum that points and authority should be rejected. There was no ruling that there was no further statements on it. This is a tribunal, not a court. And there are plenty of statements, and nevertheless, and evidence that was provided with the motion to dismiss about the SEC filing and their failure, their lack of a failure before the SEC to name this person, and their complete failure in this case to name the person who was the 10% owner. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. We're going to take a motion under advisement. Okay, so that raises the number of motions under advisement to three, or four rather. Okay, and we'll issue a decision writing on those pending motions as soon as we can. Okay, the next order of business was the pre-hearing conference, and I guess the big issue is do the parties still desire a hearing in this matter?
I certainly do.
Okay. And I believe at some point, Mr. Brown, you did file a request for a hearing. Okay.
Xerox did as well.
Yeah, I believe, yeah. Because we had this motion hearing in the context of a pre-hearing conference in April of last year, so. Okay, so the next big issue is when are we? We're still looking for. Yeah, they would still have to file this list.
Mr. Kamasha, may I ask a question, though?
Yes.
With regard to the motions that are currently pending, I'm wondering if a decision on those motions would serve to substantially limit the issues that would actually be brought up in a hearing on this matter. I'm not sure if other counsel would agree or not agree with that regard. So I don't, is it possible, we ask that the hearing actually be scheduled after we receive decisions on the pending motions so that that would make it easier to identify the matters that need to be addressed in the hearing itself?
Well, as you're reviewing, you know, I actually reviewed the motions before coming to this hearing. The motions actually, or the decisions on the motions, if any, actually would not, in my opinion, affect the actual issues of the appeal. And the reason for that is really two of the motions are motions to disclose other parts of the procurement record, okay? Or that's one way the motion is disclosed. Another motion is to obtain information in Xerox's possession, not the government's possession, but Xerox's possession itself. Okay, then of course, these last two motions merely concern the various allegations concerning the shareholder disclosure affidavits filed by both Xerox and the appellant. Okay, so none of those issues really touch on the central issues in the appeal that was brought forth, which has more to do, I think, the center theme is the quantities and the alleged changes that were made from the solicitation itself and the contract that was actually awarded. Okay, how they might change, though, you do have a point, is if Xerox is granted more access to the procurement record. Okay. But as I stated, I don't think that they're really going to affect one way or the other the central issues.
May I speak to that? That would presuppose that neither of the motions to dismiss are granted, and that seems to be the predilection, because if either of the motions are dismissed, if the appellant is dismissed, there's no longer a protester. If Xerox is dismissed, there's no longer a contractor, and there would be no need for a hearing at that point. That's how I look at it.
Okay, but at the same time, we are going to try to timely schedule a hearing on the matter. Okay, essentially, if those motions aren't granted, it would just be a simple matter of vacating the existing dates. Okay, and clearly, it's not the OPA's intent to keep these motions hanging. They've just been held in abeyance because of the actions in the Superior Court of Law, which are now resolved. So. You'll probably be receiving decisions on those shortly.
There is a potentially other dispositive matter that hasn't been raised yet, and if I could speak to that briefly, it's the appeal before the Guam Supreme Court on the SP50-11 case, which is the appeal of the OPA PA10-10. So, you know, that's the smaller procurement of copiers that DOE had issued. And up until the point of the Superior Court issuing its decision, which was in early April this year, the two cases hadn't been really related. But I think what might end up happening is the Supreme Court could issue a decision that would affect these proceedings. What the Superior Court decided was that after DOE denies a protest, the next step is not necessarily to the public auditor, but to go to the Superior Court and file an ordinary civil action.
Actually, if I can stop you there, that wasn't the ruling, and that wasn't Judge Parsinas' ruling in SB 50 dash, I think it was 11. What he ruled was that the basically he dismissed the case for want of jurisdiction because it was filed as a special proceeding instead of a civil case. And in fact, he mentions that he doesn't touch on that issue.
Well, I agree. I mean, he doesn't touch on the issue of the OPA, but I think the implication of a action after DOE's denial going straight to Superior Court does have some implications as to whether an action before the OPA might be appropriate. So we don't know what the Supreme Court, how it's going to read that decision, or, you know, because it's a sua sponte basis for dismissal. We don't know how the Supreme Court might rule on the issue and make certain rulings as to the proper procedure after a decision is rendered by DOE on a protest. So we haven't figured out yet, you know, since it's not our basis for the dismissal, how we stand upon it. But I think it's worthy of taking some note and looking at whether or not there are some implications on the current appeal for this matter.
Okay, but we're not holding this case in abeyance for another 6 to 7 months as that case proceeds through the Superior Court, the Supreme Court. Okay. We're going to. We already have the other case go off the record, we'll just have to see if we have a date available.
I don't think so. Okay.
Good. One, excuse me, 204. Thank you. Okay. It's 212. We're back on the record after that brief recess. Okay, July the 3rd at 10 a.m. Parties available on that date, Tom?
I will be off island the last 2 weeks of June, so I'd actually ask for just a little bit more time when I get back to prepare. So I'd be willing to do it on the 5th, if that's a possibility. That's a Thursday.
Okay, well, I have to verify that time. Is that time okay for the other parties? It's a Thursday?
That's fine.
I'm not sure that one day is going to be adequate.
Pardon?
I'm not sure that one day will be adequate, so I would like to look to the 5th and the 6th.
Okay, so we will try to...
I have something, and I won't be available Friday afternoon, but if not, we can continue on Monday.
All right, so we're looking at July the 5th to the morning of the 6th. Okay. And if we have to go beyond that, we'll have to reschedule a continuation of the hearing after that time. Is that same time good for the rest of the parties? I still would have to confirm both these two dates.
At 9 on the
5th? Yeah, 9 on the
5th. At 9 on the 5th.
Yeah, is that at 9? I'm sorry, for the 3rd, you mentioned 10.
Yeah, well, that was on the 3rd I had a hearing, but I think on the 5th I could start at 9.
Okay. And that gives us a half a day then on Friday if we need it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but I'd still have to verify that time. Okay, so we'll schedule a hearing on July the 5th at 9 a.m. tentatively. This will be confirmed in a written order, scheduled order. And of course, there'll be witness lists, there'll be deadlines for that because of the party's request. I'm going to try to schedule those at least a week or two after today, simply for, I guess, give us time to work through those motions. Okay. So.
And we'll need time also, Mr. Hearing Officer, to go back and refresh ourselves on the whole file, as you did.
Well, what I'll do is, but we're looking kind of, just to give you an idea, and I'll also with this, I'll make the deadlines to file the your witness list, your briefs, issues list, and your exhibit list. Those will probably be 2 weeks before. Okay. And that would be approximately... approximately June the 21st or so, around that week. I'll spread them out a little bit. Okay. Would that be a problem for the parties?
Well, that's right around the time I leave. So I might prefer a little bit earlier, just so.
Well, you can file it earlier if you want. But this is just the deadline to file the materials.
But just for examining the other parties' exhibits, to the extent they're not in the record already.
Okay. And once again, the exhibits. Okay. When I talked about exhibits, everything you filed is already on the record. Okay. The exhibits are, strictly, in this case, limited to, if you're going to call a witness and show the witness a document,
except for the exhibits that are maybe in your record, but they're not in mine, and I don't have I haven't had any access to. And that was the nature of the disclosure request that we made.
Okay, but you still have access to the procurement record that is on file.
Right, but there's some material stuff in it.
There's some parts of it, I think, that are like that. That is subject to one of your motions. And
but those are disclosed. They will be exhibit. Just going to what you said before, that everything in the record is an exhibit, effectively. And I'm not looking to go outside the record. I'm just saying part of the record I haven't seen yet. So, but there's no objection to making those, what I do get to see, if any.
Okay, once again, when I say exhibits, exhibit lists, okay, those are the exhibits that you're going to ask the witnesses about. You're going to show a document to a witness. That's what I'm asking you about. You need not mark everything you've already filed, okay, in your previous pleadings again.
Right.
Okay, that's because those are already in the record. You can refer to them in your arguments if you wish.
Yes.
Okay. But you need not have to submit them again. Okay. Any further questions on exhibits? Okay. And we're looking for a deadline for exhibit list, witness list, on the 21st of June. In your hearing briefs, which is just a brief summary of your argument, you need not re-argue everything you've argued before. I'll make that the 28th. Of June. Okay. And of course, if that's just the deadline, so if you need to leave, you can file your stuff earlier if you so desire, but that'll just be the deadline for the hearing briefs. And of course, the deadline to file your brief on remedies. I'll tentatively schedule that for July the 10th. That's assuming we finish at around July the 6th. Okay. If you take it back, we will make that on July the 11th. For the remedies brief. And once again, that brief is just how you feel respectively the OPA should resolve the case after the hearing, and essentially what remedy you think should be applied. And that brief is not mandatory. That's if you desire to file that brief. Okay. And once again, that brief, as some parties have attempted to in the past, despite the rule, I think, being very clear on what that brief is supposed to be for, that's not a reply to the hearing. So don't try to re-argue various and sundry issues in the case that you may have forgotten. Okay, I don't take that very well. I think the decisions on motions to exclude stuff in the remedies brief stand very clear. Okay? Okay, are there any other questions? And I will issue a notice of the hearing and the scheduling order for the hearing based on those dates. There might be some minor corrections. Okay.
Will we be able to obtain subpoenas for witnesses that aren't parties?
That's correct. Okay. You can. And there is a procedure for doing so. Trying to request those at least a couple weeks before the hearing. I'm not going to set a deadline for that because some parties might determine or believe they need other witnesses up to the date of the hearing. So, but I just ask the parties try to get those requests as early as possible. Okay. Are there any other issues that we need to take up at this time?
Not from Judy.
Okay. There being none, this hearing is adjourned and we are off the record at 2:21 again. Thank you.
Thank you.